Grateful to be sober, grateful to be here. I want to welcome our two newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous, those that identify, welcome. And I hope that you're able to find something here that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like a bit nervous, I don't know why. I was sitting there, I was like, is your zipper open? And I was like, thank God for the podium, you know? And I'm just like, my mind is going a million miles an hour. I spoke earlier, trying not to tell the same stories I told before. You wanna hear the same one? Some people are like, I forgot, I didn't get to hear it, you know? Just out of curiosity, how many people here are from Al-Anon, just so I can kind of gauge my talk? All right, oh, wow. Awesome, all right, I know where I'm going, thanks. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life today. I have an amazing life as a result of strong sponsorship, the 12 steps and a loving God in my life. And you know, my sponsor's name is Mike Socchio. He's out of Riverside. He's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was on my way here yesterday, and I was like, I gotta drive 5 hours to go speak. He's like, I just got to Vegas. You know, I'm like, all right. You know, he's an active member. I need someone as active as I am. You know what I mean? It's just how it is for me. You know, and I'm a separator. You know, I'm an egomaniac. You know what I mean? If I'm better than my sponsor, I don't need to take his direction. You know. So he one-ups me all the time, which I love. I love that. And my sobriety date's October 23rd, 2002. I have a home group. It's called the South Coast Speakers Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on a Wednesday night at 7:30 in Laguna Beach. If you're ever in the area, please come see us. We'll welcome you to our group. And you need to give him some grapes too while you're fanning him over there. And my home group, the first meeting in my home group was February 6th of 1946. And I say that because I love my home group. There's a lot of history in my home group. I've heard many speakers get behind a podium, not necessarily this podium, but get behind a podium and talk about being at Chuck's house on top of the hill. And at the bottom of the hill is our little meeting on Wednesday night. And you know, and there's just a lot of history in that group. You know, I'll never forget a man by the name of John Ackerlin. John Ackerlin welcomed me in my home group, 31 days sober. He was 40 something years sober at the time, and I'll never forget the kindness that man showed me. You know, when I walked up to my first meeting, I was 31 days sober. I was it was my first day off of restriction or whatever you call it. I was at the Salvation Army. And my sponsor, who was on fire for AA, picked me up and drove me 30 miles down to this meeting, you know. And I walked up to my home group, and it was like 250 people in the meeting at the time. And he was standing out there in the greeting line, and he welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, kid. And I'll never forget the softness of that man's hand. I'll never forget the kindness that he showed me. He didn't care where I had been, who I had done it with, if I was an addict, if I was an alcoholic, if I had a home, had no home. He didn't care about any of that stuff. He welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, come with me, kid. And he took me into the meeting, and he took me to the back where the coffee was and the styrofoam. He gave me a half a cup of coffee in that styrofoam cup. And I'm thinking, man, what a selfish guy, you know what I mean? Like, at least a whole cup, you know what I'm saying? But he knew, you know what I mean? He knew, right? He knew, right, the shaky hand. And then he gave me a half a donut. Right? I'm separating myself right from you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm judging this guy who's giving me a free cup of coffee and a free donut. And then it was stale. You know what I mean? I was just like, oh, man, if you have what we want. You know, I'm like, nah, I'm good, you know. And but that guy took me to the front of the room, and he sat me in the second row amongst giants. I mean, these guys had 40 plus years, 50 years. I'll never forget Lynn Wilder. I'll never forget Tommy Whalen. I'll never forget Johnny Crean, Frank O'Rourke. Like, it don't matter to you guys, but you have your old timers in your group, right? I have my guys, you know what I mean? My guys, these were the pillars in my life. And they sat me in the second row, and they're oh, yeah, back at World War I or whatever, before their time. You know, story after story, and I'm just sitting here thinking, these guys, man, they're gonna let me talk, you know what I'm saying? And And they laughed, there was this level of camaraderie amongst them. There was this connection. There was something happening, right? The same thing that I feel sitting here tonight, right, that I met with some friends and I met new friends, and, right, that connection, they had that connection. And they had what I wanted, though I didn't know what it was. You know, my whole life I've been absolutely lonely my whole life, and these guys had some sense of connection with one another. And then all of a sudden the meeting started, and I was like, all right, I'm out, right? Like, I'm going to go back to the back of the room, you know what I mean? Good looking out. Yeah. You know what I mean? They used to call that the slippers department, or they called it the shoe department. And they said, oh, yeah, there's sneakers and pumps and slippers, you know? And I'm going back to the slippers row, you know, and John grabbed my leg. He's like, no, you're sitting here during the meeting. And I'm thinking, I don't want to sit here, you know? But I believe that my wanting to be liked and my people-pleasing kept me doing what you guys wanted me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that guy said, sit here. And I said, okay, I don't want to sit here, right? And the meeting started. It was an hour and a half speaker meeting. And I was like vibrating. I was just crawling out of my chair. I couldn't sit there. And John put his hand on my leg. He's like, don't forget to breathe, kid. You know, oh, yeah, you know, breathing. He just helped put his hand on my leg. And I kind of got calm. My nerves kind of were like, okay. I felt safe there for that hour and a half. And if you're new, I hope you feel safe in this hour that we're sitting in this meeting, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is, a safe place, you know? And all of a sudden, she went walking out to go to the bathroom. I was like, oh, I'm out of here, you know? And he's like, we don't grab me. He's like, we don't get up during the meeting. I was like, I got to go to the bathroom. You know what I mean? He's like, we go before and we go after. It's disrespectful to get up during the meeting, you know? I was like, holy cow, man, these guys are serious in AA, you know? You know, the meeting got over. He goes, I want you to go thank the speaker. I was like, I didn't even like him. He's like, well, he drove all the way from L.A. Go stand there and thank him from driving from L.A. You know what I mean? I was like, all right. So I stood in the 20-minute line. It seemed like 2.5 hours. You know what I mean? So self-obsessed. Why do I got to do this? Stupid John, you know. Wah, wah, wah. And all of a sudden, I got up to the front. I was like, thanks for driving from L.A. You know, I'm out of here, you know. And the next week, I showed up, and I just went right to John because I wanted to be by him, you know. And the leader came up, and she was like, oh, yeah, we'd like you to read the 12 traditions. And John's like, he's not reading the 12 traditions. And my one feeling was hurt, you know what I mean? And he's like, you're not dressed appropriately to be behind the podium. Next week, I want you to show up with a collared shirt, and then you can, if they ask you to read, you can read, you know? So the next week, I showed up with a collared shirt on because I wanted John to like me, not because I wanted to read. I wanted John to like me, and I showed up with a collared shirt, and then the leader didn't ask me to read, and I caught another resentment, you know? I went up to John that one of the weeks. I was like, John, I'm having a really hard time sleeping, you know, because you hear these things. Oh, if you're having a hard time sleeping, read the big book. That'll put you to sleep, you know? So I wanted to be a little smart aleck to John, you know? I said, oh, John, I'm having a hard time sleeping. And he took me over to the literature table, and he gave me a book called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. He's like, son, this will put you to sleep, you know. And he had an accent. I think he was from Scotland or something like that. But I was like, but what about the big book, you know? And he's like, you know, he told me, he said, you need to study and learn about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that's going to save your life. Man, that guy spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous one meeting at a time. He taught me how to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and respect the thing that was going to save my life. Now, with that being said, I do have a suit. It's at the place I'm staying, but it was so hot. I'm like, I'm not putting that suit on. But I hear John's voice, you know what I mean? Put that suit on, kid. Respect Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? So I love you. But all the old-timers in my group have passed away, you know? They've all gone. They talk about the big meeting in the sky, you know? I just hope that I can carry that same unconditional love that those guys gave me. I hope that I could teach the message to the new people that come into my life. If you're new, you're like, who cares? I just can't stop drinking, you know? Me neither. When I got sober, I you know, my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I was 11 months old. I heard a kid in the back somewhere. Where's the kid at? Yeah, kiddo. Maybe they left. There it is. I welcome the kids to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for bringing your child to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love when I hear a child crying, and I love playing around. And You know, I grew up in AA. You know, I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous members weren't so concerned about the singleness of purpose or closed meetings when my mom got sober. My mom was being sentenced to prison for 10 years or go to rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the middle of the sentencing, right, the judge was in the middle of the sentencing. He's like, we're going to give you one more chance and we're going to sentence you to AA. You know, my mom's the kind of alcoholic who gets a drunk driving, and then when she gets pulled over, she tries to jump out of the car and beat the cop up, you know what I mean? And a lot of you have heard my mom, and 12, you know, of these DUI assault on police officers, she's going to prison for 10 years, you know? And I'm like, gangster mom, you know? And so she brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she'd walk in the back door, and the women in AA, you guys were so kind to me. You know what I mean? You just met my mom at the door and you grabbed me and you took me off to a room off to the side so that my mom could come in and recover. And as I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you gave me brownies and you gave me Rice Krispie treats and you brought me toys and hand-me-down clothes. And the love that I was raised with is the love that I feel in this room. If love had anything to do with alcoholism, I'd never taken my first drink. If knowledge had anything to do with alcoholism, I'd never taken my first drink. I literally sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night of my life. I could recite chapter 5. I could recite the 12 traditions. At the end of the meeting, I held hands. I'm like, keep coming back, you know. And the old timers told me, we're saving this seat right here for you, kid, you know. And I had no clue what that meant, but there's my seat, you know. And, you know, so every night of the week, my mom and the women in AA would get the newcomer woman. And we would go to Denny's after every meeting. And they would drink coffee and they would smoke cigarettes and they would talk to the newcomer woman until 2:15 in the morning after the bar closed. And I knew that because I would fall asleep every night at Denny's. And I would wake up and I would be home. And sometimes my mom would bring the women home to our house and they would detox on our couch. There wasn't detoxes and treatment centers on every corner, at least in Orange County, that there are now, you know. And I watched a woman die of this disease on my mom's couch in her living room. Like, I knew what alcoholism, well, I knew what drinking did to people. I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous did to people. You know, I remember telling my mom, I'm never going to drink, I'm never going to do drugs as a little kid. You know, I'm like the little kid in the DARE program, you know what I mean? I'm just saying no, I'm signing the pledge, I mean the pledge. You know, I already suffer from more when I was a little kid. You know, I had the little red band and I saw someone, they had 10 bands. I was like, how'd you get 10 bands? They're like, I signed 10 pledges. So I ran over to the cop. I'm like, I want 10. He's like, I got to sign 10 pledges. You know, and I would sign the 10 pledges. And then someone had more than me, and I would do right, you know. But I was never going to drink. I was never going to do drugs. And I grew up in AA. We would, me and my little friends from AA would come, and we'd ding-dong ditch the neighborhood. You guys would be in recovering, we would cause trouble outside. We would hit the same doorbell every week because the guy would chase us, you know what I mean? I love that adrenaline, you know, and we would run and hide in the meeting. And we'd hide amongst you. And the guy would come in the back door, he's like, where are them damn kids? And you guys are like, there's no kids here, you know? And you taught us how to con and lie and manipulate and But there's a lot of characters in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I'm saying? And my mom would be like, oh, here, meet Uncle Tom. He's going to teach you how to fish, you know what I mean? And some goof from AA would take me fishing and meet Uncle Jeff. He's going to, you know, whatever, you know, Boy Scouts, you know? And my mom put everybody in my life as a mentor, but I couldn't connect to another human being, you know? And the best way to describe myself as a little kid, I'm like the little kid in elementary school that smells like poopy pants and syrup. You know what I mean? I'm just like awkward. I'm super weird. You know, my hair's like, you know. I got the hand-me-downs that are too big. You know, I'm like a right fielder on the baseball team. Any other right fielders here? One guy. Thank you. Appreciate it. You know, no one's like, yeah, right field. You know what I mean? We all know it's a loser position. You know what I'm saying? I throw the ball as hard as I can that way. It goes like 10 feet that way. You know how serious the baseball coach is, you know what I mean? He's going to win all these games, you know what I mean? He sees me. He's like, oh, loser, right field. Or the ball, he doesn't say that, but that's what I hear. Loser, right field, or the ball's never hit. You know, I probably would have been diagnosed with ADD. I don't know. I'm like in left field wandering off, you know what I mean? And somebody told me that if I found the thing with the, what was the thing called? The white thing, you blow them all off. The dandelion? That if I blow off all the dandelion things, I can have a wish, you know what I mean? I'm like in left field wandering off, you know? The coach is yelling at me, the other side of the field, kid. You know, I'm like, okay. I'm like wishing for a different life in left field. And man, my perception to life is skewed. It's twisted, you know? One time I was on second base, I didn't even know how I got there. I was terrified. I didn't even know if I had the right cleats on, the belt, the shirt. I mean, I was like so obsessed with me already. Kid cracked a line drive and I ran back to first base, you know? And it was like a triple play in the wrong direction and little poopy pants back to the dugout. And as I'm walking into the dugout to get my mitt, my other teammates are running out. And what I heard him say that day is, you're a failure, you're a loser, and you're no good. Now, none of them said that, but that was the voice in my head long before I ever took my first drink. Loser, failure, you're no good. And I remember looking at my mom and she's in the stands clapping. So proud of her kid. And not proud because I triple play in the wrong direction. My mom was proud because it took me an hour to get out of that stupid car to go to that stupid field one more time. And my mom was proud. I had enough courage to get out of the car. But I remember looking at my mom that day, seeing if I only had a dad, that had never happened. And I built a belief system that was going to separate me from you, and I had no idea. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I had no idea that I had suffered from a spiritual malady. I had no idea that I suffered from a mental obsession. I had no idea that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my problem. I've already identified my self-centeredness as a little kid long before I ever took my first drink. And if you're new, you're thinking, I really don't care about your childhood. But it has absolutely everything to do with what the next story is I'm about to tell you. And the next story that I'm about to tell you is when I took my first drink of alcohol. And I was 9 years old when I took my first drink of alcohol. Remember the DARE program, kid? I made the promise I'm not gonna drink. I was at an AA meeting of all places with my mom. It was a Saturday night. Me and my friends from AA were running around the meeting. And when I talked about the characters in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was this guy, he stood outside the meeting, he had a trench coat on, he had an eye patch on. He smoked cigarettes and he was pissed. I mean, he was, you know, I know today he was a chronic relapser, but I didn't know that back then. You know what I mean? I just saw this angry guy. We would like throw little pebbles at him. He would chase after us. One time he had this block and he put these big nails in there. He goes, come with me, kids. And he took me and he put it behind the old timer's car. And he goes, I'm going to see how much serenity they have now, you know? And dude, he was a character. You know what I mean? He was fun. We joked around with the guy and I threw a pebble at him like I did every week. And he went to grab me like he did every week. I kicked him in the shin like I did every week. We ran through this hospital. These kids were 14 and I was 9. And we ran out the hospital up the stairwell of this parking structure. And those kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I didn't know what alcohol was going to do to me or for me. But I knew deep down within that if I didn't drink it, those kids weren't going to like me. And the bottle got to me, and I was terrified about drinking that alcohol that day, but I had to do it. I put that stuff back. I absolutely hated the taste of tequila. I spit it out, and I was overcome with fear. And what that fear told me was that I wasn't going to be like the rest of my life. And the bottle went around a second time, and I got that bottle that second time, and I was excited about having it. And I wasn't excited about getting drunk. I was excited about having some friends that day. I took that bottle and I tilted that thing back and I talked myself into holding that tequila down. And I held that tequila down that day, and I can tell you the exact effect alcohol has on this alcoholic body. In that moment, all that fear went away. In that moment, I felt like I connected to those kids. In that moment, I felt a part of. And that's what alcohol did for me, was it connected me to you. In that moment, I felt a part of. And I didn't get drunk that day. I didn't run off the skid row that day. I couldn't get booze because mom was going to AA. Right? I couldn't get alcohol. But something switched inside my head. And I didn't know what that switch was, but at 11 years old, I forgot the promise. I forgot the DARE program. This kid handed me a joint, and I smoked this joint, and this little elf chased me around the park. Man, I had the time of my life. One more time, I connected to a group of friends. One more time, I felt a part of. You know, alcohol and drugs gave me the power to go out there and live this thing called life. Alcohol and drugs took little poopy pants and gave him some sort of power in order to live with the normal people in this world. And by the time I was in high school, it was 1992, I lived in Mission Viejo, California, but I was listening to gangster rap, and I had size 50 Dickies pulled all the way up. I had a 5XL sweatshirt. I drank malt liquor because gangsters drank that. You know, I poured beer in the curb for the dead homies, you know. And you know, the parents were telling us, you can't listen to that music. You're being influenced. I'm not being influenced, you know. And my mom found a bag of weed and a fifth of tequila in the house. Now, my mom is like an active member of AA. She would like fly to Kansas to speak for the weekend and have a full-blown party in her house. My mom would speak in Idaho. I'd steal her truck for the weekend, you know. And one time I came out of a blackout. I had my pants on my ankles, and I was peeing all over my mom's fish tank. You know what I mean? Just an absolute wreck. My good AA mom. And she said, you can't drink and smoke weed in my house. And I don't know how you hear that, but I hear I need to hide it better, you know? She's like, in order to live here, you cannot drink or do drugs. Pretty clear. Alcoholism tells me, hide it better. The logical mind says, okay, if you want to have a home with food, no drinking, no drugs. Alcoholic mind says, hide it better. And so I hide it better for, I don't know, a month or so until she caught me again. And I come out of a blackout. I'm standing at the door that day, and I ring the doorbell, and my mom comes to the door, and she looks at me, and she's holding another bag of weed and another bottle of alcohol. And she says, you're kicked out. And I was 17 years old, and I packed my backpack, and I went into my bedroom, and I packed a backpack, and I walked by my mom, and I looked at her right in the eyes, and I said, I'm going to do everything I can to ruin your life. And I watched my mom's heart break right in that moment. What my mom said that night, she said, you can stay here and be sober or go out on the streets and get loaded, but you need to make a choice. Alcoholism told me that I was kicked out of the house. Alcohol was already making decisions in my life at 17 years old. Though I don't know that I'm an alcoholic. Though I don't know what alcoholism is. I don't know how you deal with shame and guilt. I had so much shame and guilt, man. I puffed my chest out. I grabbed my mom by the collar, slammed her against the wall. F you, I hate you. You're never going to see me again. My mom was my hero. My mom was my best friend. And alcohol told me to put my hands on my mom. And I left that night, and I watched my mom's heart break. And I went to an abandoned house where I was getting loaded at, and I took my first hit of crack cocaine at 17 years old. Disease of alcoholism is progressive. I have already identified my alcoholism as it relates to alcohol. Drugs aren't a problem in my life yet. Alcohol I'm drinking on a daily basis at 17 years old. I needed Alcoholics Anonymous at 17. And the first call that my mom got was a year later. And I called my mom, collect. And I said, Mom, I need help. I said, I've been hit by a car. I need to go to the hospital, and I don't know how I'm going to pay for the hospital. And I was living in San Francisco, and my mom said, well, why don't you give me the address to the hospital, and I'll send them a check. I was like, oh, no, Mom. I said, I think they need cash. She said, well, I don't know how I'm going to give you cash. I'm in San Francisco. You're in San Francisco, and I'm in Orange County. I said, there's this thing called Western Union right down the street from your work, and you just go down there and you fill out the little paperwork, and you know, and I can get the money. And my mom was terrified she was gonna get the call that her son bled out. She went down there and wired me the money just like that. And a week later, Clumsy got in another accident, and my mom ran down that little Western Union and wired me the money. And my mom would wire me $150 at least once a week for the next 8 years. When I was a kid, I was put into the YMCA when I was a kid. My mom never went to camp when she was a kid, and so she would put a little bit of money every week so that I could go to camp every summer. And my perception was that my mom didn't want me around and was sending me away. But in that camp experience, I became a counselor in training, and I became a counselor. By the time I was 17, when I got kicked out of the house, I was a counselor at camp. By the time I was 18, I was a director of that camp. And by the time I was 25, full-blown alcoholic drug addict, because I could pull it together for like 60 days. Well, I'd get a girlfriend or a mom or however you want to look at it, you know, and she's like, I love you so much, you know, but you have to stop. And so I would pull it together for 60 days and I would get a job and I'd go back to school and I would do good. And then all of a sudden I'm drunk and I'd pull it together and I would, you know, so at 25 years old, I get this job as the assistant director for an after school program. Full-blown drug addict, alcoholic at 25 years old. And the first day I go there and I meet these elementary school kids and they're just love Pat-O. And I'm balancing things on my chin and they just love me and they're swinging around, you know. Day two, I show up and they can't wait to see me. And they're excited to see me. And all of a sudden I got a bright idea. I ran down to the liquor store and I got a pint of tequila. I called my drug connection to bring me what I needed. I went right into that bathroom stall at that elementary school and I put back that tequila bottle and I passed out. And I came to with the director of that camp, breaking through that door, and I was fired from that job at 25 years old. And I called my mom and I was like, Mom, I need help. Like, and my mom said, you're gonna go to one treatment center, and she sent me to Betty Ford. And the only thing that happened at Betty Ford for me was I fell in love with this girl. We weren't allowed to fraternize, so I wrote her a note. We never even had a conversation, but we wrote notes and we fell in love. You know, and I was a drug addict when I went to Betty Ford. I wasn't an alcoholic. Alcohol wasn't my problem. And so I got out of treatment to go to Hawaii to be with my girlfriend. We had the same sobriety date. You know what I mean? It was like real love. Same treatment center. I had the pom-poms out for recovery, and I was going to do this thing. And the flight attendant asked me what I wanted to drink, and so I ordered a Heineken because I was an alcoholic. 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii. Now, I didn't hear in treatment it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Right? Wrap your head around that one, new guy. First one. I was always like, drink through that. You know what I'm saying? But I got off the plane that day and I thought, sober living or bar, sober living or bar, sober living or bar. Here I am thinking that I'm making a choice, not knowing that alcohol is making the choices for me. Not knowing when I put that first one in, alcohol is going to make every choice for me from that day till I got sober. I said, man, I'll go to sober living tomorrow. And I walked in the bar and I ordered another drink. And that girl ended up overdosing and never making it to Hawaii. I never saw her again. And I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous like I talked earlier. I talked about going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous because I would call my mom because when at treatment we had family program. Dude, family program was a bust. Because they told mom, like, you should probably practice some Al-Anon, you know what I mean? And so I would call my mom. I'm like, Mom, I need money. And she's like, no. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, no's a full sentence. And I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, well, Mom, if I only had a dad, I wouldn't be in this situation. And I'd hit that guilt button, and she'd run down there and wire me the money. And I'd call my mom and tell her how much I loved her and how much she was my hero, and she'd wire me the money. And I needed to get a job, and I needed clothes for the job, and she'd wire me money. And then she would get to say, I'm going to set a boundary. Oh. Mom, if you wouldn't have kicked me out of the house, I wouldn't be in this situation, and she'd wire me the money. And in her days of practicing some Al-Anon principles, I couldn't get the money, but I manipulated her to give me a plane ride back to Los Angeles, and she flew me back to Los Angeles. I landed at LAX and I went straight downtown to Skid Row in LA. I went straight to Six in Los Angeles. And I would be on Skid Row for the next year and a half. And in and out of AA, identifying as an addict. Alcoholics don't want addicts in their rooms of AA. dying of alcoholism, not knowing what alcoholism is. And I would leave AA and I'd come back to AA identifying as alcoholic and an addict, and people would laugh at the newcomer in the back who doesn't know how to identify around here. And I leave Alcoholics Anonymous and I go out there and I die. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't showered in 6 months. I had 2 shoes, only one had a soul. I was absolutely crazy. I was looking for my one friend, Chris, who didn't exist. I just run up to people and go, have you seen Chris? I don't know where Chris is. And they'd just be like, get out of here, kid. Get out of here, kid. Get out of here, kid. I saw the devil and his troops. They followed me wherever I went. I had a beach cruiser with 2 sticks. I twined them together like a cross, and I rolled around Skid Row like that. I had one line in the sand. If I had to push a shopping cart, then I would get sober. I was better than the guy pushing a shopping cart. So I had a friend who had a shopping cart. I just put my stuff in his cart, you know. And I got sober on the 23rd of October. On the 20th of October, I'm the kind of alcoholic. I'm a straight man, but I'd walk up to West Hollywood and do a gay bar, and I'd flirt with enough men to get enough alcohol in my body and hope that I would make it out before I blacked out. And some days I would, and some days I wouldn't. And on the 20th of October, I crawled out of a motel sexually assaulted for the 12th time. I absolutely hated myself. I was full of shame, full of guilt. I was terrified, and I was alone. And I knew that if I did the drugs anymore, I was going to end up back at that motel. But I knew that if I drank alcohol, everything would be all right. And I went to the liquor store. It was 5:30 in the morning, and we were walking in circles. And it was the longest 30 minutes of my life. And I sat on this wall, and the madness and the terror was so intense. Now I was going to crawl out of my skin. I was screaming on the inside. The demons were getting at me, man. And I remember when the lady opened the door to that liquor store, I got that sense of ease and comfort at once. Just knowing that I was going in to get that pint of tequila. And I walked in that liquor store and I got that pint of tequila and I took the cap off and I tossed the cap, because who needs the cap? And I put half that bottle back and I sat back on that same wall and I was like, and the conversation started to go. This time it's going to be different. This time you're going to call your mom and you're going to make it right. And this time you're going to get a job. And this time you're going to go back to school. And this time it's going to be okay. And in the middle of the conversation, another voice said, drink that second half of that tequila bottle back. And I put that second half of that tequila bottle back, and I blacked out for 3 days. And I came to on the 23rd of October, 3 days later, doing the exact same thing I did before, 3 days before. And I came to that morning, and I had a moment of clarity some people talk about. For me, it was a spiritual defense that walked right in between me and that first thought of that first drink. And it said this. It said, call your mom and ask for help. And I picked up the phone. I said, Mom, I need help. And my mom said, I can't help you anymore. She said, just stay right where you are, and someone from Alcoholics Anonymous will come and get you. She said, if I come and get you, I'm going to end up killing you. And she hung up on me. And my mom tried to call every high-profile old-timer in Laguna Beach to help her kid, and none of them answered. And the guy that answered had a year of sobriety, and he had just gotten off the phone with his doctor that told him he had 4-stage cancer and he had 6 months to live. And the next call that he got was from my mom saying, I need help with my son. And I'm so grateful that that man was operating on the responsibility statement in Alcoholics Anonymous without judgment. The responsibility statement says, when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. He didn't say, have the kid call me. He said, where is he at? And my mom gave him the address of that motel I was at. And he went and picked up a new guy, because he knew if he didn't treat his alcoholism, he wasn't going to make it 6 months. And he got this new guy, and they drove to that motel, man, and they barged in the front door. This guy's, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. His hair was all, you know what I mean? And the other guy was on a walker. He's like, my name's John. I got 90 days sober, you know? And I'm like, oh, my God, dude. Here I am. I'm like, these guys are losers, you know what I'm saying? Like, couldn't you send me some hip, slick, and cool guys, you know? And I'm separating myself from you, right? I'm not letting you help me. Here were these guys coming for fun and for free, and I was judging them. I know that the grace of God entered my life, though I didn't believe in God for 10 years. That guy Jack said, come with me, kid. And I got off the bed and I followed that guy to that motel. I got downstairs with the van. He said, get in the van, kid. And I got in the van. We started to drive to a detox called Charlie Street in Costa Mesa. It's a low-bottom indigent detox ran by members of Alcoholics Anonymous. No medication, no therapy, no nothing. Sit down, shut up. We don't want what you have. You want that kind of AA. Sat down on tables like this and read the big book. But they told me their story on the way to the detox. And this guy was like, oh, yeah, I drink and I go to the hospital. And John's like, oh, yeah, I go to the hospital, too. This one time I drank and I ended up in the hospital. And Jack was like, oh, yeah, I drink and I go to the hospital, too. You know, and they were going back and forth. And I'm like, dang, aren't they ever going to let me talk, you know? And just like, whoa, it's crazy, man. Before he knew it, I ended up at Charlie Street. Now, I hadn't showered in 6 months. I'm sitting on the couch thinking, man, they don't ever clean these things, do they, you know? And I talked about Pete, right? Pete came over. Earlier, I talked about Pete. Pete came over, and Pete told me his story. He talked about drinking and going to prison. But what happened for me was I said, I drink, and I go to jail. And then Pete grabbed another guy, and that guy drank and went to jail. And he grabbed another guy that drank and went to jail. And pretty soon, there was like five or six of us around that couch telling our stories. If you're new, we're a storytelling society. We come here and we tell our story. And through telling your story, what happened was my alcoholism woke up. I started to see that I drink like you guys. Though I go to a different place than you, I drink and I go to jail. And all of a sudden there was four, five, six of us around this couch drinking and going to jail. I hear all the time, like, you know, we all drank the same. Let's talk about recovery. I need to hear your alcoholism. I need to hear it. And that little Jack guy squeezed on over, man, and he started to talk about the thinking that preceded his first drink in the hospital. I was like, man, we're talking about going to jail. I didn't say that. I was thinking it. We're going, you know, why you got to talk about this? But he started to talk about all these ideas, right? And I started to see that when I was in jail, as I was getting released, I'd have this conversation with myself. And that conversation always started off with, heroin's your problem, Pat. You can drink alcohol. And I get out of jail and I call for a ride. I drink one, shame, guilt, remorse goes away. I drink two, I drink three, I drink four, I drink five. Pretty soon I got this idea to go down the street. I go down the street, I meet a new friend. Before you know it, we're business partners. He said, what happened, Pat? I said, I ended up back in jail. He said, what happened that time? I said, same thing, you know. Right before I get out, this drug's my problem. Alcohol's not my problem. I get out, drink six beers, waiting for my ride. And I started to tell him over and over, drug, 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 never alcoholic, never alcoholic, never alcoholic, never alcoholic, never alcoholic. Always holding on to my right to drink. He looked at me and he said, Pat, if you can concede both propositions, physical, that when you put alcohol in your body, you can't stop and end up in jail. And more importantly, when you're in jail, you have a mind taking you back to the thing that's gonna kill you. He said, you might be alcoholic. And I started to cry. He put his arms around me and he said, what's wrong, kid? And I said, I'm alcoholic. And he looked at me and he said, you're never alone from this point forward, kid. And he lit up like a chandelier. He's like, I got a new guy. You know what I mean? He was excited, man, because we know, right? When we're with new folks, man, and that light comes on, that identification happens, we can see it. And he lit up, man, and he got the book out, and he was reading more about, you know, we agnostics, and he was talking about God, and I'm like, nah, bro, that's a God deal? I was like, wait a second. Well, he's like, no, well, it's about a higher power. I'm like, oh, miss me with the word games, dude. You know what I mean? What about a power greater than yourself? And I'm like, oh, my God, dude. I'm out of here. And he switched the conversation on me, and he talked about the 12 steps. When he walked his daughter down the aisle, he had joy. He talked about when he was at the baseball field and he watched his grandson hit the ball, the happiness he had for his grandkid. I came to believe that if I did the 12 steps, I could have joy and happiness for another human being. I made a decision to do what he told me to do, and he said, I want you to take a shower, kid. And I thought, how did he know, you know? absolutely delusional. You know what I mean? And I went upstairs and I turned the water on. I was terrified. I turned the water on. I fell down on the ground. I started to cry. I don't know how long I was down there for. I was broken. And that guy got down on that detox floor with me and he held me down there and he rubbed my shoulder. He said, kid, it's going to be all right, kid. It's going to be all right, kid. It's going to be all right. And he held me down there. I don't know, it seemed like hours, seemed like days, seemed like lifetimes. And something inside of me, I know the power of God was used in that servant in Alcoholics Anonymous that day, because I turned and I looked at him and he looked right into my eyes and he said, I love you, kid. And I got a little bit of trust for another human being. He said, I want you to stand up, kid. I stood up. He said, I want you to take off your shirt. I took off my shirt. He said, I want you to take one step in. I want you to take another step in. He was holding me in that water as I shook violently. And the guy took a washcloth. He took a bar of soap, and the man scrubbed my back. And for the first time in my life, I felt love from another human being. I was 27 years old, and for the first time in my life, I felt love from another human being. The same love that I can feel in this moment is the same love that I felt on day one when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was like a hook that pulled me right into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'll be waiting for you downstairs, kid. He said, there's some clothes on your bed. And I went into my detox room and I went into the bed and there was clean clothes. And I remember putting those clean clothes on. I remember putting on that brand new pair of socks. He allowed me to have the only bit of dignity that I had left. He didn't break me down, he built me up. And I walked downstairs, man, I had a sense of pride for the first time in a really long time. And I got downstairs and I sat on the couch and he opened the book where it says, though our decision is vital in the third step, it has little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things that have been blocking us, which is an inventory, fourth step. And I started writing inventory day one. The next day he came, and I read my fifth step to that guy. And he started to talk about, sober living, because it was only a 10-day detox. He was talking about the sober living, and I was like, oh, no, I got to go to the Salvation Army. He goes, why do you have to go to the Salvation Army? I said, I was court-ordered there. He goes, oh, you were court-ordered? I said, yeah, I have a warrant, too. He's like, oh, great, we're going to turn yourself in, you know? And I'm thinking, nah. Can we get like 90 days, you know what I mean? Get some letter from AAers, you know, doing a great job, you know? He said, no, we're going to go down there tomorrow. It was day 4 days sober. He said, everything's going to be all right. You're sober and you have God in your life. I said, I don't believe in God. He goes, you can borrow my God. And I had an old timer. First day, he said, I don't care if you believe in God or not. He said, what I want you to say is, God, I don't believe that you exist. But this old guy told me to pray, so pray as if you believed. I said, oh, okay. I never did it. But that guy went and picked me up, and then he put me in a suit, and he took me to that jail, and I was looking at 3.5 years in prison. And I walked up to the judge says, Mr. Ochoa. And I said, yes, sir. And I'm standing there in my suit that was like five sizes too big, you know what I mean? And he goes, do you remember the last time you were in my courtroom? I said, yes, sir. He said, do you remember what I told you? I said, yes, sir. He goes, I'm sentencing you to 3.5 years in prison. I wasn't lying. And the guard came and cuffed me up and took me to the holding tank. And I got on my knees. And I said, God, I don't believe that you exist, but this old guy told me to pray and get me out of jail, please. Amen. I started having that conversation with men have failed you your whole life. You put your trust in this sponsor guy and he told you everything's going to be all right. And you're going to prison. I'm getting cuffed up to the guy next to me as I'm getting onto the bus. I go to stand on the bus and the guard says, Mr. Ochoa, I don't know what's going on, but the judge wants to see you one more time. And they uncuffed me from the guy next to me. He went on the bus and I went up to the up into the courtroom and I'm standing there and the judge looks at me and the judge says, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm going to give you another chance. He said, there's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he pointed over to the corner over there, and there's that goofy sponsor from AA. He said, he's been sitting there all day fighting for you to get out. And there's a bed available for you at the Salvation Army. It was like a Tuesday at 4:30 in the afternoon. And Anaheim Salvation Army will let you in Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. I'd be there at 5 in the morning. And what had happened was my sponsor, he was a headhunter. You know those guys? If you're here, I'm sorry. He called over and over and over until he got someone, you know? And he got a guy by the name of Tim Pappas. And Tim Pappas was a counselor, and he had to make some printings off his printer that was in a room he wasn't supposed to go in. But for whatever reason, he decided to walk in there, and the phone was ringing. And he wasn't supposed to answer the phone, but he answered it that day. And my sponsor said, I got this kid, Pat Ochoa. And Tim Pappas was a guy I used to get loaded with. See, God was working in my life long before I saw God working in my life. And I went to the Salvation Army program, and I was on fire for AA. I was already making amends. That was my first amends, 4 days sober. I made amends to my mom. I sat down with my mom. I was like, Mom, I said, I need to make amends. She's like, about time, you know. And I said, Mom, you remember that one time when I called you and I told you I went to the hospital? I said, that was a lie. She goes, I know. I said, you remember that one time I called and I told you I got in an accident? I go, that was a lie. She goes, I know. I go, remember that one time? She goes, I know that was a lie too. I go, remember? She goes, just stop. She said, I know that every time you called and asked me for money, it was a lie. I said, then why'd you give me the money, Mom? She said, because when you left my house at 17, you broke my heart. And I sat up every night crying until I went to sleep, terrified I was going to get the call that you bled out. And I thought that if I gave you the money one more time, it might keep you alive long enough until you could get to Alcoholics Anonymous so them good folks in Alcoholics Anonymous can help you. Here I am thinking that the real harm is that I lied to my mom. The real harm is that I robbed my mom of her security day in and day out for 10 years. And I looked at my mom and I was like, Mom, how can I make this right? And I was crying and I was in it, man. I was understood. I said, what can I do to make this right? She said, all I want you to do is I want you to get in the middle of AA and help as many people as you can. See, I came to believe in you guys. I came to believe in the stories that I heard. And I gave my mom a hug and I told my mom I loved her and she loved me. And it was the first time in my life I felt love for my mom. And I ran back to my sponsor and I was like, oh my God, you won't believe it. Alcoholics Anonymous, this healing process. And me and my mom love each other and this is so great. And all she wants me to do is to get in the middle of AA and help people. And he's like, that's great, Pat. He's like, but what about the money? I said, oh, she doesn't want the money. He said, yeah, but AA wants you to pay it back, you know. And I thought to myself, don't ever tell this guy anything ever again, you know. I go, how am I going to pay back $100,000? He goes, $25 at a time, you know. Oh, my God. And I had to write my mom a note. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you today. And I leave her $25 once a week. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you today. And I leave her $25 a week. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you today. And I leave her $25 a week. 6 months in, my sponsor, you know, he's like, you're doing such a good job, Pat. I'm proud of you. He said, but I want you to write the note every day. And I want you to leave the note or the money once a week. I thought I was doing a good job. Why don't I go do more work, you know? And so I started writing my mom a note. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you every day. Every day. And a year and two into the deal, man, the notes started changing. They were like, I love you. You're the greatest mom in the whole world. I remember this one time when I was 5, you know, the love letters, you know what I mean? These are like love letters. And I'm looking around AA and you're just getting boyfriends and girlfriends. I'm having a love affair with my mom. Like, this is weird, you know? And I call my sponsor. I'm like, I'm not going to do this ever again. This is weird, you know what I mean? And he's like, you don't have to do it if you don't want to. I'm thinking I'm off the hook. He said, but how free do you want to be, Pat? Love you and I appreciate you. You know what I mean? And I write the notes and I leave the money because I want to be free. Still selfish and self-centered to the T. I'm doing it for me. And 5 years sober, my mom took me out to dinner for my birthday and she sat me down and she said, Pat, I want you to know. She said, I no longer want the money anymore. She said, but I still want the notes, you know? I can tell you I wrote my mom a note, sent my mom a text, or called my mom just about every day until the day that my mom died, you know. I had no idea what that note was going to do to me. Writing that note allows me to look at you guys in the eyes and tell you that I love you and I appreciate you today. Even greater than that, that note allows me to look at you in the eye as a newcomer and tell you I love you and I appreciate you today. And you don't have to live the way you've been living again if you don't want to. As long as you're willing to do a few simple things around Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to love anybody. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to not prostitute myself one more day for one more of anything. You know, I've been given so much more, you know. And 90 days sober, I decided to leave the Salvation Army because they were, you know, they weren't paying me. It was free. And long story short, the judge sentenced me to 100 days in jail on a violation of probation. And my sponsor said, you get a big book in there and you study this thing like your life depends on it. And I did. I got into that jail and I started reading the book and I started underlining. And these guys were offering me alcohol and they were offering me heroin and they were offering me speed. And I didn't want any of it. I'm like, no, no, no. No, and the guy looks at me like, are you a rat or something? Are you a snitch, you know? And I sat these seven guys down and I told them my story. I mean, they had nowhere to go. They had to listen, you know? And they looked at me at the end. They're like, we don't want to give you any, you know? And but this guy came up to me and he said, Pat, he's like, I'm looking at 10 years in prison and I don't know what to do. And I shared my experience with him. I said, I went and told the judge I was an alcoholic and an addict and I needed help. And maybe if you tell the judge that, he'll offer you a program like he offered me. And the guy went to court the next day and he came back and he gave me a hug and was crying in my arms. And he said, they're going to release me to the Salvation Army. He said, but I can't stop drinking. I can't stop using drugs and you're clean and sober. Like, how are you staying sober? And I sat down with him and I read word for word and line for line out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, like my sponsor had done for me. And I talked about what happens to me when I drink and I talked about when I'm sober and the thinking. And he had a relationship with God. And he was willing to make a decision on his knees. And we got on our knees at that institution. I was 120 days sober with this guy, arm in arm at 3 a.m. And we said a third step prayer together. And though the decision was vital, he started writing inventory in that jail. And I went to the Salvation Army. I rode a bus 2.5 hours one way, 2.5 hours home every Sunday, like my sponsor had done for me to work steps with that guy. And I did that with him for 3.5 months, and that guy ended up going out and getting loaded. And here I am taking responsibility for this man. If I would have only done, if I should have. But what I came to learn was that one alcoholic working with another alcoholic allowed me to stay sober one day at a time at an institution. That man saved my life. And I caught fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 120 days on fire for AA. I am the biggest cheerleader for Alcoholics Anonymous. I will do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. If that means drive 5 hours, fly here, fly there, show up in the trenches, man. I'm not even going to say it because I don't want to piss anybody off. But you know what? I was down on Skid Row throughout COVID because most people are dying of alcoholism. If God wanted me to go, God would have taken me. And I was down there reading the book. Man, I am forever indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to make a living amends to my mom. It was the hardest thing ever. My mom took the abuse from her alcoholic father. She was thrown through a plate glass window. She was the one of the brothers and sisters that took the abuse. My mom didn't nurture me when I was a kid. My mom never really hugged me my whole life. My mom was like hugging a cactus, to be honest with you. But my mom would walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and this whole room would part. The light that my mom brought in and the love that she loved the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was always jealous of you. My mom would be with women and love on them, and I wanted that love, you know. And I had to make a living amends to my mom. And I shared about it earlier, so I'm not going to talk about it, but me and my son's mom broke up when he was two, and I had my son half-time. I have him Sunday through Tuesday, and she has him, whatever. Anyways, doesn't matter. We have him half-time. And every Monday night, I would drive 30 miles an hour in rush hour traffic to pick up my kid, to drive an hour back to have dinner with her, to drive 30 minutes back to go home. And I would bite my nails because I'm nervous disposition the Big Book talks about, and she would bark at me, stop biting your nails. Ah. I'd bounce my legs. She's like, stop bouncing your legs. She was just on edge all the time, you know what I mean? And I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. Like 7 years in, I'm like, I'm tired of getting the abuse from my mom. Like this living amends is great, but like, nah, I'm good, you know? And I talked to my friend Michelle Lyon, and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. And she said, Pat, you need to teach your mom how to love you. I was like, well, how am I going to do that? She said, you want to be kissed? You want to be loved? Kiss on your mom, love on her, hold her, hold, you know, all that. And I was like, oh, what's her? She's 40 years sober or whatever at the time. She should do it. You know what I mean? Here I am, 40 years old, right? Still wanting my mom to love me like a 3-year-old. And I started to do it, and it was so uncomfortable. And I started to do it, and it got a little easier. And I started to do it, and it got a little easier. My mom was diagnosed with COPD. The last 3 years of my mom's life, she rocked an oxygen tank like nobody's business. Me and my mom spoke in many different states together with that oxygen tank. And we were in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm like, she couldn't breathe, you know what I mean? The oxygen, she couldn't breathe. And I'm like, Mom, just get in the wheelchair. She's like, I'm not getting that goddamn wheelchair. I said, Mom, just get in the wheelchair. I'm not getting that wheelchair. I said, Mom, get in the wheelchair. And she's arguing with me. I'm not getting in that wheelchair, still trying to walk, you know, with her oxygen. And I looked at my mom and I said, Mom, when are you going to let me love you? And my mom sat in that wheelchair. And I was pushing my mom and I was so proud. I was so proud. It was like proudest moment in AA. I was like, yeah, but I'm alcoholic and I got an alcoholic idea. And I started to notice that the walkway started going downhill and I started running with the wheelchair and I kicked my legs up like this and the wheelchair's and she's yelling at me, stop, stop, stop. And we got to the bottom and she just shook her head like this, like, I'm getting you back, you know? And something shifted in our relationship. And that night we went home, went to the hotel, and I looked at my mom. I said, Mom, I love you. I went to sleep, and I woke up in the morning, and I went to the shower, and I turned the water on, and all this red water started coming out. She had snuck in and put a red dye tablet in the shower head. And I came out of the bathroom that day, and she was like, got him. And our relationship changed to a friend relationship. And I've heard many of great speakers behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, and y'all have talked about the greatest gift was when your loved one took their last breath. Alcoholics Anonymous gave you the gift that you saw that last breath. And I want your experience. I don't want to walk through my own. Just tell me what I have to do, and I'll do everything for that. And we were at my home group one night, and a beautiful meeting like every week. And my mom called me after the meeting to complain and judge the speaker like she did every week, just like some of you will do tonight. And but we don't judge around here if you're new, you know. And she went home that night, and I went to sleep, and I woke up in the morning, and her wife had to rush her to the hospital. She went to the hospital that day, and I showed up the next morning to the hospital, and she'd gotten a tumor that blocked the passageway of her breathing. And they cored the tumor out, and they put her on hospice. And my mom called me, and she goes, Patrick, I want you to know I'm going on hospice, but I'm getting off hospice. Now, let's go back 3 years right before her 40th AA birthday party. We had to put my mom on life support. And because I'm the child, I don't know what they call in the will right now, but I make the medical decisions. And my mom told me, she goes, I don't want to be on life support. If I'm on life support, pull me. And I had to make a decision to pull my mom from life support, and she made it alive back to her 40th AA party. Now, I think it was only for that, but I'm not too sure, you know. But I'm really believing that my mom's going on hospice to get off hospice. Even though intellectually I know what hospice is, right? But I don't want to believe it. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, my mom was back at the home group. She was back at the Starbucks with her book. And she called me after the home group, judged the speaker like she did every week. And that night, rushed her back to the hospital. And during this 5-week stint of her on hospice, I would go see her every day because I don't want to miss her last breath. And my mom looked at me and she said, "Don't sit here and watch me die. Go out there and live your life. But come back tomorrow, please, and give me a kiss." And I'm so grateful for the Women in Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened for me was it went full circle. I used to be so angry and so mad at you for stealing my mom from me when I was a kid. And what happened was the Women in Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded my mom and took care of my mom. And I would go out and I'd go to work and I would come back to give my mom a kiss. And she'd say, "Don't sit here and watch me die. Go out there and live your life." And I'd go out there and live my life. And I was going to Idaho to speak at an AA convention, and I didn't want to miss my mom's last breath. She's unresponsive. She hasn't talked. It's coming to the tail end. And I get on my knees and I say, "God, I don't know what you want me to do. Can you please give me some sort of direction?" And in meditation, what I heard was, "You need to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I don't like that message, so I pray day 2. "God, please show me what I need to see." In meditation, it says you need to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like that message, so I pray 3 days in a row. I get the same message, and then I go, "Well, I'm going to trick God. I'm going to call my sponsor, who's going to tell me that you need to be a service to your mom." So I call my sponsor. I go, "Hey, well, you know, this is what's going on, blah, 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 blah." He's like, "What did God tell you?" I said, "God told me to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Then that's what you need to do." Click, you know. I went and I gave my mom a kiss. I didn't tell her that I was leaving. I just went and gave my mom a kiss like she told me to do. And I got on the plane. I flew to Idaho. And right before I was speaking on Saturday night, I get a call from my friend. And she says, "You know, you need to hurry up and get back. Your mom's been unresponsive. She hasn't said a word. And you need to get back because your mom is waiting to say goodbye before she passes away." I got on my knees in this big, huge, it was in an ice rink. Literally, right before I talked, I said, "God, what do you want me to do? I'm willing to do whatever you tell me to do." And God said to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I gave a talk that night, and I went to sleep, and I got on the plane. I flew home Sunday morning, and I landed, and I flew into my mom's. I literally 100 miles an hour down to Mission Viejo, and I parked, and I ran into the front door where my mom's hospice bed is, and my mom sat straight up like this. Spirit felt spirit walk in the room that day. If you're new, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. I would have missed that moment if I didn't listen to a goofy sponsor tell me to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have missed that moment if I didn't listen to a goofy sponsor to tell me to be a service. I would have missed that moment if I didn't do the step, if I didn't make the amends. I would have missed that moment if I didn't do Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went into my mom's arms, and she put her arms around me, and she said, "Pato, I want you to know you did the right thing." She held me, and she said, "I love you, I love you, I love you." And that was the last words that my mom said. A lot of you guys know and have heard my mom speak, you know. I remember when I was brand new, I said, "I don't know how I'm going to fill my sponsor, my mom's shoes." And my sponsor looked at me and said, "You don't have to fill hers. You just need to fill your own." And I kissed my mom on the forehead and I said, "Patio, I want you to know from this day forward, I'll carry your legacy on in Alcoholics Anonymous." As hard as it is for me to talk about it, right, a lot of people love and adore my mom, and I'm sharing that with you. But what happened for me in that moment was that there was a level of forgiveness that was so profound. I'm going to pull something up, but I don't know why I'm going here, but I'm going to. There was something so profound in that moment. All my mom wanted me to do was to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and help you. And I honored my mom's amends all the way until the day that my mom died. And I didn't know what grief was. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous because I continue to show up to you and continue to be a service, and I continue to treat my alcoholism here. And I got in a relationship with a girl 4 days in, you know, bad idea. Intellectually, I know, you know, it's just craziest year of my life, you know. And finally, just a long story, so I'm not going to go into it, but I mean, I was had to seek some outside help. And in that, talking to this lady, I knew that I owed my mom an amends. My whole life, right, I blamed my mom for not loving me the way I deserved to be loved. But where had I been the one to bring the love forward to my mom? I myself had a part in that relationship. I blocked that love. And so I knew I had to make this amends, right? And so I go and I have her ashes and I find this tree. And I'm like, okay, this is the spiritual place to do it, you know. And I sit down and I make this amends and I ask my mom. I say, Mom, I can make the amends. And I say, Mom, what can I do to make it right? And the message that came was, be open, honest, transparent, be kind. Talk to Eden, which is my son, about your struggles. Be emotional with him. Be gentle. So my story in the beginning was I cheated on women for 8 years in sobriety. I made it right. I haven't done that since then. It's been 11 years because of the power of the steps. But I heard her say, don't cheat on women. Follow your dreams. Don't give up on your dreams. Bring those you love close to your heart. Be welcoming. Face your fears. Live life to the fullest. Be gentle. Forgive yourself, for I have forgiven you. And I got terrified. I literally jumped off my seat and I fucking ran. I was like out of there. I'm like, dude, I'm gone. Like, this is too much. Like, I don't know what's going on. I didn't know if I was tripping. I didn't know what was happening. And I felt this intuitive pull to go back to that tree. And I sat down by that tree and I said, Mom, what more do you have to tell me? And she said, you're a beautiful man with such a gentle, kind, loving spirit. Your compassion and understanding for others is remarkable. You're a true messenger of a loving God. You are confident. You shine such a bright light upon the world. Accept your darkness, for that is where your light shines. You have an amazing life, and so many positive things are just around the corner of the place you stand today. Be patient, be strong. Continue to be a service to others. I used to always say, the old timers would say, don't leave before the miracle. But they would never tell me what the miracle was. You, son, are an amazing man. Don't give up. You're an amazing father. You have taught Eden how to be kind, loving, gentle, and care for others. Continue to provide boundaries and structure in his life with your kind, gentle spirit. I am proud of you. You have become an amazing man. Keep getting closer and closer to God and keep helping others. Just keep saying yes, Patrick. Even though you don't believe like you are loved by God or that you are not being guided, I want you to know your life is about to get amazing. You have gone through a lot, but your strength is inspiring to so many. You are loved. I love you, Patrick. The last thing I want to say to you is forgive yourself. Everyone in your life has forgiven you. It's time to let go of the shame and forgive yourself. You're a good man with a huge heart. I love you, Mom. P.S. Let go of me physically and know that I am with you always. I used to always throw my pennies away, because who needs pennies? And I heard a story about this rich guy in Orange County. Wealthiest guy in Orange County used to save his pennies. And I was like, I don't know, 5 years sober. And I went to my mom and I said, Mom, I said, this guy saves his pennies and I throw them away. I don't get it. And she looked at me and she goes, oh, pennies are from heaven. All right, pennies are from heaven. I can tell you, since my mom died, I found a penny on the floor just about every day. I pulled into this thing in right here and I got out of my car and there was a penny. I can tell you that I'm closer to my mom today than when my mom was physically alive. My name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic and I love you all. Thank you very much.